welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the February 9, 2020 episode, focusing on 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 through 16, New Perceptions. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm David Adams.
And I'm Bert Montgomery.
Well, it is cold here in Kentucky, and I think even for Nikki and Bert in the southern states, it's cold,
it
right?
It is cold.
It is, and I would remind you, Kentucky is a southern state.
Well, yes, Kentucky very much considers itself a southern state. But as the crow flies, you would go south to get to Bert and Nikki.
Well, yes, we're further south. We're the real south, but nevertheless. Yes.
So the truth is, yeah, cold is relative.
That is true. I don't know what you do for entertainment in the cold winter months, but Regina and I have reservations to ride on a dinner train here in Kentucky this weekend.
Ooh.
And it's actually supposed to be snowing some on Saturday, so it could be really pretty. But yeah, you ride the train, and they serve you lunch, and it's like 2.5-3 hour trip through the countryside. And, you know, so I think it should be fun. It should be a nice outing. I don't know if you guys do you have any train experiences?
I rode a train one time in India when I was studying abroad in college.
Oh, wow.
It actually had two train experiences. One that was booked for us by the university that we were with. And we rode first class, which means you had air conditioning and it was just a little nicer. But then when we traveled on our own, as poor college students, we traveled third class, and that was very, very different. But yeah, it was an interesting experience traveling by train in India. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, too. It was cool. Yeah.
Awesome.
I had the little train that went around in a circle in my floor when I was a kid.
Was motorized fun. Or not motorized?
Motorized.
Went, awesome.
Oh, yeah. You turn it on. And
yeah.
Did you put that little stuff in the chimney and it'd make smoke?
No, mine didn't do that.
Okay.
And I wanted to be like the Addams Family and get another set and have them crash into each other. But that, never got around to that.
Well, however you enjoy your winter weekends, I hope it's good. We are in 1 Corinthians. And Bert, would you help us get started with this one?
Yeah, I'll do my best. You know, there was a time in my life, and boy, it seems so long ago now, when I was a young, budding theologian. I was in high school, and then I was majoring in religion at a small Baptist college, and I loved diving into the wordiness of Paul's letters, and then opening a commentary to tell me what I had just read. I felt I needed to at least sound like a future Pauline expert by being able to summarize doctrinal matters at the center of divisions within the first century church in order to apply them to the divisions of the 20th century church of the 1980s. After all, since a large chunk of our New Testament is attributed to Paul, and as a Baptist, I was supposed to know why I'm more right than all the other not quite as right Christian traditions, and Paul's letters often explain why he is right against those who are not quite as right as he is, or even flat out wrong, and his words are often used confusingly with never-ending sentences filled with abstract theological assertions, followed by judgments against heresies and diatribes against false teachings of impressive people-pleasing pastors who lead astray new believers with their theologies and perverted teachings, while Paul simply and humbly relies on the proof of the power of the Holy Spirit above all human wisdom. Excuse me while I catch my breath. You know, the first time I remember reading William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, I thought, I have no idea what's happening here, but at least Faulkner is easier to read than the Apostle Paul. But hey, that's neither here nor there. Years ago, I gave up on pretending to enjoy and pretending to understand Paul, and I decided to trust trustworthy, practical theologians whose brains are wired differently than mine, like Nikki, for example. So I direct you to Nikki's Bible background. She's good at deciphering and explaining Paul to me, and I think she will be for you too. And she gives us a good synopsis of the debates and the divisions in the Corinthian church and a synopsis of what Paul is getting at here. However, there are a couple of things that do capture my imagination in our text today. Verse 2, "For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." And then verse 16, "We have the mind of Christ." For so long I have heard the first verse extrapolated out into abstract treatises about doctrines and beliefs and afterlife things and such, and taking it out of the earthly economic and political realm in which Christ was crucified. And then the latter verse has often been used by men exerting their authority, or at least feigning humility, by explaining what the mind of Christ means to those who don't know what it means, to listen while listening to authoritarian pastors who speak so impressively that they obviously do have the mind of Christ. Oh, gosh. Anyway, so when I ponder all of this in the life and the teachings and the crucifixion of Christ as revealed in the Gospels, it seems to me that there's something about Christ and Christ's crucifixion that involves the embracing of suffering and sacrifice and rejecting power and wealth and worldly gain. Something about agape love, transforming, redemptive, humble, generous, no strings attached, self-giving love. Now, remember how I said earlier that I depend on the practical theology of wiser persons than I to help me grasp what Paul is saying? So I found these words from Lutheran pastor Mary Hinkle Shore, who explains our text in a way that, for me, jives quite well with the Gospels. She writes, according to 1 Corinthians, the leaders will act as servants, the strong will refrain from exercising their freedom at the expense of the weak. Love will prove greater than prophecy, tongues, and knowledge. To have the mind of Christ is to be able to imagine the new creation and participate in it before it has come into focus for others. And as God's Spirit calls and equips the church for that imagining and participating, the new creation actually comes into focus for the new world. So I appreciate Pastor Shore explaining it that way, because that does make sense to me in light of the crucifixion of Christ and the mind of Christ as revealed in the Gospels. And now, if you'll excuse me, all this long-winded Paul talk is wearing me out. Where's my Faulkner collection?
Oh, Bert. That is often how I feel after reading Paul. That's exactly what it's like. You captured it perfectly. Oh,
I find it interesting sometimes that in an effort to make the scriptures mean something, sometimes we deliberately avoid talking about what they mean. And that's always a lot of fun. You know, here we have a letter written by somebody to a church that was undergoing all kinds of internal strife, mostly because different people were rising up trying to get people to follow them. And some spoke better than others, and some did better than others. And so now he comes in and starts basically just getting to be a part of that conversation, being a part of the argument. And he's making his point, even though he wanders around, because he's trying to drop in subtle statements and jabs and digs at the other people in the argument. And he's trying to talk about what's really important, where what truly matters beyond the argument. But all of his subtle jabs and dings and clever turns of phrases and all the cool things that Paul's trying to do to really stick his finger in the eye of the people who he's arguing with suddenly turn into this mystical theology about spiritual discernment that is confusing to everybody, and therefore Paul did a bad job. Always funny to see that happen to the guy. There's a joke that I like to tell. I was threatening to tell it in a sermon, and it's a Steve Martin thing that he used to do back in the late 70s and early 80s when he was doing his stage act. And he would just be talking to the audience, and he said, "Yeah, remember, it was like that time when the earth blew up. You remember that, you know, when the earth blew up? They didn't tell you about that? You remember that? The earth blew up, and so the government decided that before the earth blew up, they'd get us all in this giant space ark and fly us to this planet. You don't remember? And you know, we all set ourselves up, and we got our society going again. Remember? And then they decided not to tell all the stupid people because, oh, wait, never mind." I always want to do that in a sermon, but I almost get the sense that Paul's doing that here too from time to time. Mm. There's just little things he drops in here from time to time. I'm reading that and I'm thinking, that's interesting. What do you mean by that when you say things like, these people don't understand what I'm saying, or I decided to know nothing among you except for this. Among the mature, we do speak wisdom. You know, little things that talk about how, well, we know some things, but, you know, we don't want to come out and say what they are because maybe you're not ready to hear that yet. Or maybe, again, it's another subtle jab at the people who are caught in this life and death almost argument with Paul, where they question even whether he should be in any ministry anywhere. They call him a crook and a con man and try to lead people in the church away from him. You know, a person in the middle of that, which is where he was in the Corinthians correspondence, is going to say some stuff, you know, and they're going to be subtle in ways we don't understand anymore because we just don't speak that language. We are too far removed from the situation to understand it. So sometimes it gets confusing, and there are times when we may lift our hands up and say, hey, this is an argument Paul was having with some people, and he might have been really whipping on them back then, but it just doesn't make sense to us now. We just don't talk that way anymore. And maybe there's some element of that in this passage.
So what you're saying is that God did not dictate to Paul word for word to talk to us today in the 21st century.
Probably not. If you read back in chapter 1, there's even a spot where Paul says, I really hope I didn't baptize some of you people, and I'm glad I didn't, because look what happened. We missed that part when we're reading this particular chapter. If you go back to the previous chapter, though, Paul's clearly upset.
Paul's upset a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he kind of stays that way. He has pretty high stress level.
Yes, he does. Think.
Yeah, but you know, and we've talked about this before, but the older I get, the more I understand, or the more I know I don't know. I think he's upset the way we tend to be upset. Whereas I used to always think he was upset at the way the fundamentalists say he's always upset. But now I think, no, he's probably more upset the way we're upset, because they just don't get it.
He definitely, in this passage, he certainly comes across as impatient. He's impatient with their lack of maturity. And to me, it sounds like Paul is saying, I have told you these things and you're fighting about this, but I've told you this isn't what it's about. And it's really about this. And of course, he goes into the kind of seeing things through the view of the crucifixion. But he's certainly impatient and irritated with the Corinthians.
Yes, I think that does come out. You're right. He is really talking like a person who's upset and impatient. And there is kind of a foot stamping. I told you this once. Don't you get it?
Right.
It has to work this way. Mm-hmm. And there's also a little bit about, don't hold me up to the standards that the rest of the world has for what it means to be wise, because that's just not the way it works. Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking about God along those lines, you're totally missing the point here.
Right.
But he's not so clear sometimes at how he says it. The passage I was referring to, by the way, was chapter 1, where Paul says, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius, so that no one can say they're baptized in my name.
I think we should have like a reading of all the snarky Paul comments.
Oh, there's a lot of good ones for that.
It's really
snarky.
We
could do a calendar.
but again, there's a point here, too, is that Paul had some very real human moments where he was dealing with some important stuff or rough spots that took place as you're trying to form a church and you're trying to keep people together. You're doing this in an environment where the church might not even be legal and where you've got people all coming in with different perspectives and all these things. And probably Paul wasn't the most level person anyway, in his personality, probably got a little bit excited from time to time. So you might want to think that, okay, this is to be expected, because if we were in the same situation, wouldn't we be talking a little smack too? And wouldn't we get a little loud from time to time and a little frustrated from time to time? And isn't that just how humans work when they're in these kinds of situations? But in this rush to make all of the people whose names appear in the New Testament as some kind of holy other that is above us, we tend to lose sight of that. And we get a little disappointed with them maybe, or we make more of some things than they might be otherwise. Mm. And we really don't seem to be able to tolerate when they act just like we would.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's such an important point. The scripture is really just a story of humanity and the way that humanity encounters and interacts with God. And so this story of like these early church people, they're human just the way that they are. And they've probably got the same kind of characters in their community that we have in ours.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the guy who falls asleep at the sermon all the time, but I mean, he's going to show up every work day. And you've got the little old lady who hands out peppermints, and you've got all those same human characters, and they're just trying to work things out and figure things out the same way that we are. And I think when we look at the church in Corinth, that there's a lot of relevance for us today. David, I think you brought this up when we were kind of in our preparation documents ahead of time, in that they were a church that was deeply divided. They had factions. They were fighting. They had strong disagreements about things like baptism and communion and the way that we worship together and what's important and what's not important. And it feels a lot like the way that we are all divided today. And I think that if we can do what David Adams is saying and understand that they are human just the way that we are, that we might be able to learn a little more from them than kind of elevating them way above us, and understand that there's a lot in common.
Right, like if we see how they as humans dealt with something, maybe there's something in there for us to see in ourselves, how we might deal with the same thing.
And I think Paul is challenging them to recognize that the thing that he teaches, that the gospel message of this man that we call Jesus, how he died on the cross and lived this self-sacrificing life, is so different from the way that they do anything, and that we have to completely reorient. He was challenging them and their culture, because their culture, the way that they, I'm tumbling over my words now, but in that Corinth culture, this idea of wisdom and being well-spoken and making good arguments, it was the way that they lived. It was a pastime. It was a very important part of their daily activities. And Paul is challenging that. And Paul is saying, the things that you use to measure what is good and what is wise and what is powerful are not the right measuring tools. You've got to use something else.
And I think, Nikki, you're right. So I'm old and you know, I can't remember a time, at least in my lifetime, when the church has been as divided as it is now, polarized. And it's partly because the church exists within a polarized culture, where we are so quick when we meet someone, when we listen to someone, when we're having conversations, we want to slot people into one of two positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it distorts our ability to communicate, to think clearly. And I guess I wonder if we need to hear Paul in the sense that he calls us to look beyond these things that polarize us, these grids that we bring to try to interpret where people are. Are they left? Are they right? Mm-hmm. And instead calls us to honor and follow this Christ who was crucified, and calls us to live in the world in a way that is very different than left or right, and is beyond those. And I wonder, because I really do wonder, as a person of faith who believes in and hopes for the church in this day, if one of the roles the church is being called to in this fractured time, it is to play the role of a peacemaker, to play the role of a voice in the culture that calls us beyond choosing A or B. I don't know. But it does seem really relevant because I know when even for faith element, I mean, used to curriculum was easier, but it's like everything we write, we have to worry, well, are we sounding too left? Are we sounding too right? Are we sounding, because you know, people react, they immediately slot and they react. And I wonder, I wish for and hope for a time when we can truly seek the Spirit, truly seek God's wisdom among us without predetermining, you know, that there's a right side and a wrong side, and which one are we on? Mm. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And that makes Paul's words a little bit different too. One of the things that this brings to mind when I'm hearing this is that I've started to do Facebook lately because I work at a church now. We do Facebook a lot, so mm-hmm. I have to do that. But there's a group that I'm in called Exvangelicals, which are people who've pretty well left the faith or deconstructed, as they call themselves, and are trying to pull away. And for all the stories they'll tell, and they have very good reasons for wanting to. I won't argue with any of them and the reasons for doing this. But for all the stories they tell, you get this sense that, you know, if Christianity could just scrape off all this extra stuff, all the arguments, all the things people laid on it, all those little extra things that really don't need to be there, and just got back to the purity of an actual honest faith, they never would have left. They wouldn't have been hurt. It would have been a wonderful thing for them. Hmm. But we do that because we have all of our baggage we want to carry and unpack on it. All what Paul was referring to here is human wisdom that yes. we want to put there. All those things that Paul is complaining about here, we've piled and piled and piled this on top of faith to where it just doesn't work for them anymore. You know, if we got down to just the spiritual again, to just faith again, and got rid of the rest, Christianity would be a lot better. And it could be that Paul is a couple thousand years ahead of us, seeing this coming. Mm. And saying, hey, here's what idea I had in mind when we were starting this church, and it's just not happening here. Can you scrape off some of this stuff and just get back to the basics? And maybe this passage just kind of reflects that kind of a concern.
So what you're saying is Waylon and Willie ripped off Paul when they sang, let's get back to the basics of love.
Sure.
It's all in Luckenbach, Texas, but still.
Well, I think it's really an interesting passage that we're presented here with in 1 Corinthians. Mm-hmm. And part of, I think, what's perplexing for me when I read a passage like this is that I often, you know, we hear Paul and others in Scripture call us to not follow false prophets, to not follow false teachers, to not follow the earth's wisdom, the world's wisdom, but instead to follow God's wisdom, as if it's easy to tell the difference, as if we're not able to be easily fooled. You know, how do you know which one is God's wisdom? Because there are lots of folks who are happy to speak for God. Mm-hmm. And let us know which way we should be going and how we should understand wisdom.
And happy to identify the others as false teachers.
Exactly, exactly. So I found the words of Parker Palmer about this issue interesting. He writes about discernment, and he says, discernment is key to every wisdom tradition. It's about sorting out the stuff of life, the experiences we have, the people we walk with, the signs and signals we pick up by asking good questions about their meaning and importance in the living of our lives. And he points to this poem by William Stafford, which is a bit like Paul, mystical, a bit cloaked and hard to grasp, but at the same time, maybe holds some clues for some of the kinds of questions we would ask if we want to discern which path, which approach seems more in tune with God's wisdom. So it's not a religious poem, so to speak. Anyway, it's called Deciding, and here's how the poem goes. One mine the Indians worked had gold so good they left it there for God to keep. At night sometimes you think about your way that far, that deep, or almost. You hold all things or not, depending not on greed, but whether they suit what life begins to mean. Like those workers, you study what moves, what stays, you bow, and then, like them, you know. What's gold? What's God? And what's world? And Parker Palmer takes that and he says, maybe a similar question that we ask is this. Is this life-giving for me and those around me? Or is it death-dealing in ways small and large? However we work to discern the spirit and work of God, perhaps this is a good question to help us. Thank you all for this good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.